Hello everyone and welcome to Fraser's Capital Podcast. Today I'm having a chat with an old friend, Dr. Robert Stretch. Rob studied medicine at Yale and did research at MIT and did a lot of work at the Beth Israel, which is one of Harvard's teaching hospitals. Rob also helps us out on some of our life sciences investments, and I hope you enjoy this conversation. Hi Rob, how's it going?
Hey Mike, it's going well, thanks.
So you are obviously grew up in Australia. We actually went to school together. You ended up doing medicine at Yale. How did you get from Sydney to there?
You know, at that time in my life, I was very interested in going into medical research and basic science research. And when I was looking at options, you know, right before starting medical school here in Australia, I looked across the pond and I actually had a foreign exchange experience where I went over to Cornell for a year. And I just found the experience over there in the US universities to be very rich. And the sort of research that was going on and the way that it was open to people of all, you know, backgrounds and levels of experience, found that very interesting. And I was encouraged by one of my professors to apply to a US medical school. And I was fortunate enough to be accepted by Yale. And I took them up on their offer.
And then how did you choose where to go after that?
So after medical school, towards the end of medical school, you actually interview at all around the country, if you are open to moving anywhere in the country, for a residency position. My residency was in internal medicine. Where you go really depends on a few things. You know, one is what's going on in your life, obviously. If you're married and your partner's family is in one location, obviously that might be a factor. From a career standpoint, if that's your focus, then it might be that you know of a researcher or a group of researchers at a particular university or medical center that is just the group that you want to work with, and that have a particular focus that's just right up your alley. For me, I interviewed very broadly. I interviewed all over the US. And eventually, the place that I actually chose to train was Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, which is in Boston. It's one of the three core Harvard teaching hospitals. So there's Mass General Hospital, Brigham and Women's, and then Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. And they have a very, very complicated, mind-boggling web of an interaction where some residency and training programs are shared between all three sites. Some are just in two hospitals. But I chose Beth Israel because they had an interest in medical technology innovation. And actually, one of the people who really helped clinch that decision for me was a guy by the name of Dr. John Palamka, who, if you Google John, he's very well known in the EHR interoperability space, and was instrumental in BI forging, a real niche for itself in this regard.
What was your research actually on?
So when I went to BI, BI's short for Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, I teamed up with Dr. Leo Celli. And Leo runs a group at MIT called the Laboratory for Computational Physiology. When I was working with them, the lab's core focus at that time was they had become the curators of a database called MIMIC. So MIMIC stands for Medical Information Marts in Critical Care. And so what they did was they said, well, where do we have the most medical data being collected on patients in our institution? And the answer was undoubtedly the ICU, the intensive care. You know, you've got vital signs that are collected. If you're talking about EKG tracings, then, you know, you've got data being collected at 256 data points a second, right? Like a week long or 2 week long stay. Just that's a mind boggling amount of data. And that's just an EKG tracing. You have respiratory rate, all the vital signs, as well as all of the laboratory data, all of the imaging data, chest x-rays and CTs. You have freeform data from you know, clinical documentation, doctor's notes, and the medications that you're infusing into patients or administering orally, you know, route of administration. And they collected all of this. And you've got to imagine, I'd have to look up the exact year that they started it, but I think it was around 1990. Like, that was a long time ago, well before this became the norm. So they were a very forward-looking and forward-thinking institution. And this lab became the curator of this database, you know, when it eventually became, essentially a full-time job to curate this database and to make it publicly available. That was the other thing. The database was made available to the public free of charge after it had been de-identified, you know, professionally and carefully. So it was a monumental task. This lab took it on, and my research was to use that database to understand the way that overcrowding and a shortage of physical beds in one particular ICU could impact upon outcomes for patients, which ironically, you know, years later, you know, at this point, has become extremely relevant. But what we found was that if your ICU, that where you're physically located and you're taking care of patients, if all the beds are taken up in that ICU, but you still have to admit a patient, if that patient goes to another physical ICU, say across the hall or upstairs, and you're not in line of sight of that patient, then they're out of sight, out of mind. And we found their mortality was higher and their length of stay was higher and their ICU length of stay was higher.
Who decides who goes where in the hospital?
So this is a whole art we have people who are called bed facilitators. So there's somebody who is employed in a hospital to just make decisions about where to move people. This is why when people say, well, wouldn't it just be easy if hospitals did this? You have to understand that hospitals are very delicate operations and they've evolved over a long period of time. I'm not saying that they're perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but they are very sophisticated and complex, such that we need somebody whose dedicated job is just to decide who goes to what bed when. But yes, the bed facilitator in combination with the ICU attending, when it's an ICU patient being admitted, would decide on where a patient goes. And so often we would have to play this game, so to speak, of especially if there are two patients in the emergency room who both need an ICU bed, but you've only got one ICU bed, you play the game of who gets the ICU bed in the main, you know, unit where you are, and who gets to quote unquote board, is what we call them boarders. Oftentimes, or the conventional wisdom was, you put the sickest patient in the last ICU bed that you have in your central unit because they're sicker, they need more care and more eyes on them at all times. And, you know, that may very well be the right thing to do.
Right. I mean, I guess that became pretty pertinent lately when there was such demand on ICU facilities.
Right. So, you know, the US is now been in a situation in recent months where there's just no option. You're not getting a choice about which unit you're going to. You're just thankful to have an ICU bed. And there have been occasions, especially in those real peak months over December, January, where we didn't have enough ICU beds. We did run out, and we just had to deliver the care that we could.
Let's come back to that. But what happened after that? Because I know you have an interest in sleep apnea. How did you go from doing, I guess, complicated statistical analysis on hospital bed placings to researching sleep?
So to just give you the full spectrum of, you know, my shifts in research, at Yale, they require you to do a thesis in order to graduate. I think it might be the only medical school that has that requirement. And my thesis there was on mechanical circulatory support, which is things like ECMO, which is where they take the blood outside your body, pump oxygen into the blood artificially, and then return it to the body in order to keep people alive. That was my medical school thesis. And then in residency, I swung towards bed allocation and logistics in order to improve patient outcomes. And then you're right, when I went to fellowship, I ended up pivoting my research to sleep. And, you know, part of this was really just a result of circumstances. I did a sleep fellowship as part of my pulmonary critical care and sleep training. And I found a great mentor in the sleep department. And I would say actually that probably explains all of my pivots in my research over time. In my experience, it has been just hugely more important to find the right mentor than it has been, at least up until this point, for me to find the right research topic. You know, I think early in your career, you really just need exposure to different methodologies of research and, you know, different perspectives. And then you're naturally going to find your, you know, your calling, you know, whatever topic that is or whatever area that is in terms of research later in your career. And really that tends to happen towards the end of your training when your clinical niche, you know, what you're going to spend your time on treating patients, when that really has been fleshed out. So I didn't have a problem with switching research area or topic if I found a great mentor in a different area. And at UCLA, which is where I did that last piece of my training, I found an absolutely tremendous mentor who, you know, I work with still now. I'm actually, you know, involved in multiple projects still with this person across two different countries. So that just gives you an idea of the strength of that, that, you know, mentorship.
So what actually is sleep apnea?
Are you asking for personal reasons, Mike, or?
I sleep like a baby. I'm fine.
So sleep apnea, you know, just generally speaking, is where during sleep, the airway passage, you know, which extends from the mouth and nose down to the lungs, where the passage there gets obstructed. So it closes up. And you might ask, well, how can that close up? Well, there's a lot of soft tissues that make up that passageway. It's not a rigid pipe. There are portions of it that are more like a rigid pipe, but there are many portions that are soft and floppy. And during sleep, especially in sort of this portion, we see, especially in people who are a little on the heavier side, overweight or obese, we see, but not only in patients who are overweight or obese, we do see airway collapse. When the airway collapses and closes and obstructs, then air can't get to the lungs. And you can imagine that that's a problem because you can't take a deep breath or you can't take a breath at all. When air can't go from the atmosphere down to the lungs and you're asleep and you're trying to take a breath, that awakens you out of sleep in order to prevent you from dying from suffocation.
So these people are constantly waking up throughout the night.
That's right. So repeated nighttime awakenings, often but not always with a sense of choking or coughing or gasping for air. You know, those are sort of the sorts of signs of sleep apnea. And it's manifest in the daytime, you know, after you've gone through this all night. It's often, but again, not always, manifest by daytime sleepiness and fatigue. You know, the urge to just lay down and have a nap at some point during the day.
And is it something that people are kind of aware of? They're like, I keep waking up in the night, or they're just like, I'm really tired and I don't know why.
So this is one of the fascinating things about sleep apnea to me is, you know, human beings have a great capacity to adapt to their circumstances and to begin to think that something is normal, not just for them, but for other people. Because sleep apnea is not, you don't have it one day and then you suddenly have it the next day, and in a very severe form, because it's something that, you know, you develop gradually over time and it worsens gradually over time, often as perhaps you gain additional weight and proceed along the trajectory towards obesity. Because of that, it creeps on insidiously. And so people just say, this is how I always have slept. This is how I've always felt. They rationalize, they come up with rationalizations for why they're waking up in the middle of the night. One of the most famous ones, although there is actually a deeper physiologic reason for this as well, but one of the ones people come up with is, I need to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night. I woke up because I need to go to the bathroom. And sometimes that's true, but in what we really find is that when we treat patients for obstructive sleep apnea and they've previously said, that's why I'm waking up in the night, it's because I need to go to the bathroom. In a lot of cases, that need to go to the bathroom actually goes away.
So if you're waking up in the night to go to the bathroom, then you may well have sleep apnea.
Yeah, I mean, it's not quite as simple as that, but it's one sign that you may need to consider it. People, when they go to their doctor and they tell them, I'm waking up in the middle of the night, I need to go to the bathroom. Unfortunately, still to this day, many doctors will say, oh, well, if it's a man that's coming to the doctor and saying that, then automatically it's your prostate, and you need to take this medication and that'll help you to empty your bladder more fully each time you go to the bathroom and you won't wake up in the middle of the night. And that's not an unreasonable place to start. But if that medication doesn't work, that doesn't solve the problem, you may need, or if you have any of the other symptoms of sleep apnea, like daytime sleepiness, you may want to consider just getting a sleep study.
So is this something that kind of affects elder people? Is it something that kind of worsens with time?
So the prevalence of sleep apnea increases with increasing age. That is definitely true. We are certainly seeing, again, especially in the United States, where, obesity is unfortunately, such a significant problem affecting so many people, that we're really seeing a lot of young patients as well afflicted by sleep apnea. So yes, it's a risk factor, age is a risk factor, but it's not the only factor.
What's the two questions? What's the current standard of care and what are you working on?
Right, so the current standard of care is CPAP, which is continuous positive airway pressure. It's what people most commonly associate with the diagnosis of sleep apnea. It involves a mask of some description over the nose or over the face, and it involves a small machine by the side of the bed that generates a flow of air that goes into the airway and helps to sort of stent it open or keep it open while you sleep. For patients who tolerate CPAP, it is currently the standard care and the most effective therapy. It has its problems, but I do believe that that patients should be offered that upfront to see whether they get a benefit from it and whether it works for them.
So Rob, you're currently working remotely in ICUs in the United States from Sydney. How is that happening?
Right. Yeah, great question, right? I mean, sounds a little bit on the crazy side. Look, I think to start with, it's really important to explain to you what this is not. This is not telemedicine like many Australians would have experienced telemedicine with their GP or a specialist during the pandemic. It's not a laptop and a home internet connection. And if you're going to deliver ICU care to critically ill patients who are often sort of on the brink of death, you really need an incredibly robust and reliable setup. So, on a technical standpoint, that means you've got to have, you've got to be prepared for blackouts. You've got to have an uninterrupted power supply and a generator. You need a totally redundant workstation as a failover. You need 24/7 dedicated IT support, redundant internet connections, the whole shebang. But the technical setup is just one aspect of it. The other thing that you really need is an excellent sort of clinical team that is tailored to delivering tele-ICU care. And at all the sites that I work at, and I work at, across 8 states in the US, multiple different hospital systems and multiple hospitals within each hospital system. At all these places, they all have a central, you know, nursing hub staffed by experienced ICU nurses who are watching over all of the patients in all the different ICUs in all the different hospitals that I might be delivering care to simultaneously on shift. So it's a very large operation.
Right, so what will happen? You'll be there on a screen somewhere. You're like a robot that's walking around.
So I'm typically on a continuous video link throughout an entire shift with the, you know, nursing core or hub. And, you know, they're monitoring patients. They'll bring patients to my attention. And then once a patient is brought to my attention, I have, you know, immediately access to their chart, all of their vital signs, labs, notes from their clinicians, et cetera, et cetera. And then separately, separately, I have access to a camera that is actually in the patient's ICU room. And this is a high definition camera where, you know, I mean, it's good enough that you can, you know, zoom in and do an examination of the oropharynx, you know, the back of someone's throat, the side of the world, if that gives you an idea. And I've actually done that on occasion, you know, when it's really needed. You know, if you're accessing that camera, you can talk and see in real time, and the patient and nurse can see you as well. And so it's really just like stepping into the room. The one limitation, of course, is that, you know, you can't physically, you know, put your hand out and touch the patient. But, you know, as we can talk about a little bit later, there are ways that you can compensate for that.
How do you compensate for that? Just a nurse can be our hands and feet on the ground, I guess.
Well, so that is one thing, right? I mean, if it's something simple like I need to get a closer look at you know, the patient's leg or abdomen, their belly, or their chest, then I can just ask the nurse to, you know, make sure that part of the body's you know, visualized or able to be visualized. I can ask them, you know, how cool or warm are the extremities, the arms and the hands. But if I need a clinician's impression, hands-on impression, there is always somebody in the hospital. You know, there are colleagues of mine that I can reach out to and say, listen, I was called about this patient. This is what I'm trying to determine. Can you help me out? Can you go into the room and do an assessment of this? You know, and that's never a problem. It's not a favor either. That is an expected part of the system that we have set up in these hospitals.
How new is this idea of these remote ICU doctors?
So surprisingly, it's not actually that new. And that wasn't necessarily something that I was aware of until, you know, the last about 2 years. I would say that it's risen dramatically or increased dramatically in scale and size of the operation in COVID, during COVID. And, you know, you might ask, like, why would a hospital even do this, right? I mean, even in the time of COVID, you know, what's in it for a hospital? Why don't they just employ the doctors to be there in the hospital? And I think you have to remember that, you know, let's just talk about the US at this time. The US is a very large country, and there it's split into urban and rural areas. And just like Australia finds it difficult to staff hospitals in rural areas, or GP clinics in rural areas for that matter, hospitals in the United States can also find it difficult if they're in a relatively rural area to find all of the appropriate, all of the different types of specialties that they need in order to run a full hospital, right, and deliver care to their community. And ICU clinicians are one of the types of specialties that, one, there probably just aren't enough ICU doctors generally in the US for the size of the population, but two, especially in rural areas, there aren't enough ICU doctors. So that's one part of the problem. It's just a workforce shortage. The second part of the problem is that some of these hospitals might be quite small, or at least their ICU might be quite small in terms of the capacity. You know, they might have four patients in their ICU at any given time. So having hiring an ICU doctor to work a shift to take up care of three or four patients is not the most efficient use of resources, right? There's going to be a lot of downtime in that situation. And that means that there's, you know, financial waste. What would be a more ideal situation for these hospitals is if they could buy a portion of an ICU doctor's time during a shift, right? In order to take care of their four patients. And if multiple hospitals took that approach, you know, each say bought a quarter or a fifth or whatever it is of an ICU doctor's time, albeit remotely, then that becomes a much more viable proposition.
All right. And you've been treating coronavirus patients in these ICUs?
Yes. I think every man and his dog is treating coronavirus patients if they are in any way related to healthcare right now.
So what typically happens? When are they coming into the ICU? Is it pretty kind of late in the progression of the disease?
It is. I definitely am seeing the sickest of these patients. By the time that they come to me, they're really on the absolute maximum amount of oxygen that can be delivered without a breathing tube.
Right.
So, you know, it doesn't need the room to...
My understanding is like a lot of the issues with, you know, with COVID is it's kind of like an immune response, kind of in the later stage of disease, an extreme immune response that causes all kinds of damage. You have to go through like, as a practicing clinician who's treated these patients, go through that progression of the disease, what causes it, how, you know, just that whole life cycle of what happens. Because it's actually surprisingly foreign to Australia. There's probably not even that many doctors here that have actually treated it.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, that's true, especially, you know, in states aside from Victoria. I'll preface this by saying that most of my experience is at this late stage of COVID, right, where they're on maximal amounts of oxygen, just by virtue of what my job is. But, you know, generally what, or a common story that we'll see is that a patient is actually diagnosed outside of the hospital, you know, by their local doctor or at one of these mass testing sites that they have in the United States. And they'll know that they're positive for a couple of days, usually, prior to coming into the hospital, say about, you know, 3 or 4 days. Sometimes
a positive test, they'll be at home.
Yep, they'll be, you know, hopefully self-isolating at home, away from other people, and just taking Tylenol, which is paracetamol or Panadol. That's what they call it in the US, is Tylenol. Taking Tylenol for fever, trying to keep up their hydration status with fluids, and just bed rest. Then they're coming into the hospital several days into that, or at least a subset of patients are coming into the hospital several days into that course. And they're usually coming in for worsening shortness of breath. Sometimes they're also coming in for chest pain, chest discomfort, especially chest pain with breathing. So that's very related to the breathing cycle. That sort of chest pain is called pleuritic chest pain. And it's typically a sign of inflammation of the pleural lining, which is the lining of the lungs. It's just a very characteristic sign that we see as doctors. They'll often, or I'd say most often, require at least a few liters of oxygen per minute at that initial presentation. Sometimes it's more if they've really been trying not to come into the hospital, if they've really been avoidant of care, which unfortunately is something that we saw a lot of because people really felt like they would just get worse if they came to the hospital, or, you know, there's a lot of things that go through these patients' minds.
Yeah. What's the right cause? Is he supposed to go sooner or later?
Look, if you're having worsening shortness of breath, you should come to the hospital. If you have an oxygen, a device to measure your oxygen at home, that's ideal. And I believe that a lot of health systems started to give patients these devices at time of diagnosis so that they could monitor their status more closely at home. Because that's really the, you know, while there are other manifestations of COVID, that's really the one that most commonly necessitates hospitalization, is the need for additional oxygen. So they're told if their number goes below a certain number in this device that they should come into the hospital. They then come into the hospital. We give them a cocktail of medications, you know, which are a whole separate line of discussion about, you know, what the relative efficacy is of these medications and whether or not they should be given.
What are they given?
So hydroxychloroquine is definitely not given anymore.
Definitely not given.
The evidence is conclusive on this matter, and I don't think that this warrants a lot of further discussion. Remdesivir is one that is still being given in U.S. hospitals. There are some criteria that you have to meet, but we do give it. Remdesivir's effect on the clinical trajectory is fairly small or very small if it has an impact on the trajectory at all. It mostly has been shown to reduce the duration of viral shedding. So that's not something that directly impacts how well a patient is going to do, funnily enough. A lot of the damage is already done at this point. The other one that they may be a candidate for, especially if they're requiring oxygen, is steroids. So dexamethasone was shown in a clinical trial to have a benefit. I think that, plays into the idea and the, fairly well-accepted notion that a lot of the damage caused by COVID is related to the immune system's, the immune system causing bystander damage.
Right, it's just being overreactive. So why would older people have a worse time with COVID than younger people?
Right, that is a very interesting question. I think that's actually, really one of the pieces that we don't fully understand. Certainly, that I don't understand. We often think about older individuals as having weaker immune systems. I think in general, yes, that's a generalization, but that is what people think.
It's probably a clue there. It seems the wrong way around.
What's interesting is that when you look at pandemics, like most influenza pandemics, for instance, it has typically been older patients that have a harder time or a rougher time and are at greater risk of mortality. And, the one exception to this was was the Spanish flu, because that actually hit young people actually in some ways harder than the elderly. And understanding that, I don't know that there's ever been a full explanation for, why there is some this variation in age as a risk factor.
I had an interesting comment from one of my friends at Oxford who was involved in the company that did the virus. He was kind of like, we don't know. His comment was, he kind of thought there could be something to it, but he said, we don't know the incidence of blood clotting in a heavily infected population. So in places like the UK, and it wouldn't be true in Australia, but in places like the UK, coronavirus has gone through and just swept through and obviously infected a huge portion of people. So effectively the United Kingdom is almost like a pre-infected population of COVID. And so a lot of statistics for things like blood clotting or other things, we don't actually know. They could be different now than they were after.
I would say that based on the pathologic mechanism what we are now calling vaccine-induced thrombotic thrombocytopenia, that there is not so much doubt that this is a side effect of the vaccine. The incidence of these side effects is perhaps, we have some initial estimates, although I think we're still trying to pin down a more precise estimate. It is going to be above the background rate of occurrence in the general population because of the pathology, the type of antibodies that are developed, which is similar to those that develop in a condition called HIT, which is heparin-induced thrombotic thrombocytopenia. So I don't really have any doubts about the fact that this is a true side effect of the vaccine. I think people need to understand how rare this is. I think that, you know, look, first of all, my opinion doesn't matter that much, right? But for what it's worth, and because you asked, I would say that if I was in Europe and somebody offered me an AstraZeneca vaccine, absolutely, absolutely, I would take that vaccine. And I am under 50 years of age, right? If that is your option, and there is no other option, you take that vaccine now. I think Australia is in a unique position for now, where what the government has proposed, I think, is right. It may not be perfect, but I do think that they have struck the correct balance between managing and mitigating risk and still, you know, vaccinating or offering to the most vulnerable portion of the population vaccines that we have available today. In answer to your question, would I take the AstraZeneca vaccine, you know, in Australia at this moment in time with our current level of cases? I think, you know, I would do exactly what I just said, which is I would follow the government advice that has been given, because I do think that the advice is sound, you know, and so that would involve me not taking that vaccine unless the situation in Australia was to change, which is a true possibility.
Yeah, fair enough. I was trying to get that answer out of you. Anyway, I think it's bizarre that we don't have this Moderna vaccine. It's truly strange. I mean, you had one that was a clear leader the entire way. It was apparent, you know, a year ago. And if you think about how much money the Australian government has thrown at the problem, you know, what was it? Hundreds and hundreds of dollars every week to, you know, job seeker, job keeper. You'd be hard pressed to find an Australian that wasn't, you know, the beneficiary of one of those things. Certainly somebody, a family who wasn't the beneficiary of one of those things. And then people talk about $40 for a dose for a vaccine being too expensive. You know, it's so out of whack. Like, the price of the vaccine is so low, but for some reason people have a mental block about paying money for these things.
Yeah.
What is it? 20 million people, $40, like $800 million done, you know, which sounds like a lot of money. It's huge compared to like all the different medical things and all the different priorities of government. Yeah. But then when you put that next to like the tens of billions of dollars that are spent on, you know, just handing cash to people to like effectively, you know, just get through the kind of government-induced interventions, economic interventions, it's just a weird mismatch. I mean, there must have been something going on behind the scenes. Yeah, and somebody's responsible for this as well. You know, at least in my line of work, we're directly responsible for what happens. But you see these decisions just get lost in a bureaucracy. Do you have any insight on that?
Right. Look, you know, I don't have any inside knowledge, you know, related to the decision-making process here. I would make a couple of observations. You know, one is that very early on in the process, you know, back in March, April, that sort of time frame, I think there was much more, I would give much more leeway to decisions that were made back then, because there was a huge amount of doubt and skepticism about whether a vaccine could actually be produced for this disease, for this entity, which today seems laughable, right? But this was a real concern in the field. And so, you know, the government went out and procured or, you know, supply agreements for theoretical vaccines from several manufacturers, including Pfizer and AstraZeneca, and, you know, these are large companies that had, you know, very good chance of being able to deliver. And I think they saw Moderna as, while a very, you know, promising biotech startup, simply not being able to scale to honor its agreements if it was to make an agreement with a country like Australia on the other side of the world. You know, so that may have been a factor. I think the other issue was that Moderna was, I believe, and I'm happy to be corrected on this if this is inaccurate, but I believe that Moderna was one of the companies along with Johnson & Johnson that was requesting a vaccine injury and compensation scheme that, was would mitigate a lot of the liability issues related to any vaccine side effects. And Australia does not have a no-fault vaccine injury and compensation scheme. And so that may have been also an additional factor that limited Australian government from purchasing J&J and Moderna's vaccines.
So Rob, we've obviously worked on maybe 20 or even 30 or more companies, across, listed and private, mostly Australian or with some connection to Australia. Do you have any first impressions on the local biotech scene? It's a very active, speculative market here, that's for sure.
Yeah, look, the Australian biotech scene is clearly alive, well, and thriving, that's for sure. I'd say one of the more interesting points that we've noted as we've looked at several companies is the most frequent reason that we pass on a company is that we don't see a clear path toward reimbursement.
Mm.
That we don't feel like that's fully fleshed out.
Well, that's the thing, right? Like all these companies, they have, it's almost like there's two implicit steps. It's if they get approved, there'll be a huge market. And they also kind of assume that if they get approved, they'll get bought out, which is also another step. There's if you read company presentations, they kind of end at approval. That's where they're going to.
Yeah.
But in the US, it's kind of different because in some countries like the UK, the approval and the approval to fund it effectively is all done by the same group, and it's kind of one effective decision. So you get into a point where they might decide that yes, this works. There's a local company that has had arguments with UK authorities for some time because it works, it's approved elsewhere in the world, but the UK won't fund it. It's the approval and the funding is together.
Right.
And you're more of an expert on this certainly than I am, but in the United States it's different, right? The FDA only does effectively says that they approve it and then judge on efficacy, but not on cost effectiveness and whether it should actually be used. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the FDA says outright that it does not consider cost efficiency when it's looking at approval of new medicines. And, if you can really believe that when you look at the prices of some new, blood pressure medications or whatever it may be.
Yeah. Does the FDA rule on standard of care, or is that done separately, by groups of key opinion leaders or something?
No, the FDA does not wade into decisions about what standard of care is.
Right. So would they approve a treatment that was not as good as an existing standard of care, or would the FDA still need the burden to be like, this improved on standard of care?
That's an interesting question. I believe that the FDA would approve, treatments that are, less effective than existing treatments. In fact, I'm almost certain that they would do that because, having a broader range of treatments should, one individual not be able to take the standard of care for whatever reason, whether it's an allergy or, an intolerance or cost, should have access to alternatives. So that's in the FDA's interest to make those available to the American public. In terms of who develops standards of care, that's generally left up to, medical societies. So, one group that has been incredibly vocal over the years is the American College of Cardiology. They develop all of the major cardiology guidelines for practicing.
Right. And I guess that was one of the things that interested us in DermTech. Which was the company that creates a patch, effectively a bit of sticky tape to kind of test for melanomas. Obviously, at the moment, to get it done properly, you'd have to get a piece cut out of it. So having a sticky tape that could just pull it and rip up some DNA and test that is much better.
Yeah. And I think, what was really compelling about DermTech to us was that they'd really done their work. They'd done their homework. They not only had, the basic science down, and they had their product cleverly delivered and packaged, so to speak. But they had all of these publications that addressed clinical effectiveness, you know, and how this is going to be used in clinical practice, what the impact of it would be in clinical practice on patients. But they also had done cost effectiveness studies. So they had looked at, you know, can we actually save the health system and therefore insurers money by offering this product? And they showed that they could. So if you're now an insurer and you're wondering what, you know, whether you should include reimbursement for, you know, DermTech's PLA on your, you know, your formulary, then yeah, you're going to do that because you're going to save somebody from having a more expensive biopsy. They may not care about the fact that they're also offering a better service to their patient. That's a you know, side effect. But they're actually, they're reducing their expenditures.
Yeah. I mean, it's tough for us. I mean, the best companies we own in life sciences are all overseas. I mean, there's valuable work done kind of in the lower tier companies. So there's a couple in Australia, probably more than a couple, that will find drugs that have effectively been put aside. You know, if you're a big pharmaceutical company, every now and then a new CEO comes in or they do a strategic review and they go, actually, we're going to cut these programs and we're just going to focus on these. Mm-hmm. And that decision, they can sell those drugs. Other times, that's kind of it for them. But the early studies have been done. They know they're safe. They know where they go in sufficient concentrations in certain parts of the body. Mm-hmm. But I guess our sweet spot is actually similar to our sweet spot in the rest of the portfolio. It's companies that actually have strong revenues, extremely high quality, and pipelines. So I think Moderna, we've probably talked about in length, and it's pretty relevant. I guess that's up now. What is it up? Eight times at least. Yeah. Since we purchased it. So we made the call that the Australian government didn't.
Yeah.
That was Alnylam, and nobody knows about Alnylam. So Alnylam's also got a platform, right? I mean, instead of mRNA, it's RNAi. Yeah. What is RNAi, Rob? Are you able to expand on that?
you're talking my language now. So RNAi, I actually was very interested in back when I was in medical school. And there was a lot of interest in using RNAi for the purpose of suppressing HIV infection or the ability of HIV to infect cells.
Why is that?
So there are certain receptors on human cells that HIV uses to enter the cells. Mm-hmm. RNAi is a technology that allows you to knock down the expression of any protein in a cell. And so if you imagine, you know, you could just knock down this receptor on the surface of
healthy human cells.
Yeah. Then you could either dramatically reduce or eliminate HIV infection. And this has been explored by multiple groups and I think is a discussion for another day, but that's how I first became interested in.
Surely that has side effects if you're knocking out an entire receptor and.
That wasn't actually one of the issues that came up. It did not seem to be disadvantageous to knock that receptor down. But let's get back to Alnylam and talk a little bit about, you know, what they're doing. So RNAi allows you to go use these cleverly designed strands of RNA, which is, you know, the next step after DNA. DNA gets transcribed and into RNA. And if you put these, you know, molecules or strands of RNAi into cells, knock down protein expression. What Alnylam has done is their core intellectual property is that they have developed the very best method of delivering RNAi therapies to the liver, right? That is their largest claim to fame, so to speak. Like if you're wanting to deliver to the liver, you really want to license that intellectual property from Alnylam, right? Now there are other companies that are working on, you know, other parts of the body that you might want to deliver it to, and that's just, again, a separate topic. But in the liver is a really rich organ to target because there are so many disease processes that are central to the liver. And I think, you know, just actually one of the most fascinating ones is one of the drugs that they have just completed phase one trials on, which is an angiotensinogen RNAi. So angiotensinogen is the molecule that becomes a molecule and another molecule, you know, with some conversion steps in between, and eventually causes or contributes to high blood pressure.
Right.
High blood pressure is, you know, one of the largest markets in the world, right? It's one of the most prevalent medical problems. We have a huge number of drugs that are varying expense and generic and non-generic status that address high blood pressure. And the very best of these drugs are taken, you know, once a day, right? That's what we've gotten it down to. Some of them are taken three or four times a day, but the least frequent is once a day. Mm. Alnylam wants to develop a high blood pressure drug that you take twice a year.
Wow. If you take it twice a year, reduces your blood pressure. That would charge some astonishing amount per pill for that.
I would say that they would be able to command a pretty penny for that medication.
Yeah, but isn't that a weird thing? I mean, there's such a strong movement towards like big pharma is awful. But think about how risky it is. Like think about all those crazily risky biotechs we look at, and it's like, wow, it might work out in 2025.
Yeah,
you need to put in like real money now, like $20 or $30 million, and that's the first of like two or three funding rounds that will take them to that like 3-5 year outcome. Yeah. The only way you can do that is if there is actually a pot of gold at the end of that. If you cut the golden goose at the end, you starve the rest of the pipeline, and you just can't make it work. You can't put It's one thing for your own money. You certainly can't put other people's money at risk for something without that. You know, that has to be, if it works, it has to work out because it's covering every other single loss in the space.
I mean, just look at what happened in 2020, right? And who saved the day at the end of the day? And it was pharmaceutical companies. We need to acknowledge that. And certainly that's been, it's been an interesting shift in my thinking, you know, both as I've you know, worked with you and looked at these companies and what their offerings are and what the risk is that these companies face in the development process, and also just in the context of COVID and the development of these rather remarkable vaccines in a rather remarkable amount of time. So there's a lot to be said for what the pharmaceutical industry is capable of.
That's just what we believe in. I mean, think about AstraZeneca and kind of decision to sell things at cost, certainly in the short and near term. And then you think about Moderna that priced their vaccine kind of higher and was very happy to kind of effectively sell it to the higher bidders. Moderna sold like 1.3 billion doses to the EU the other day. There was an announcement. I mean, I can't remember if they put the actual price there, but it looks like they're generally selling around $10 to $15 a dose. So you're talking about 1.3 billion doses, $10 plus, potentially more per dose. That's like $10 billion plus of funding that will go straight into a company with a huge pipeline of vaccines and treatments. You know, that the amount of development that will come from that and from creating a vaccine that is sold, you know, for 10, even if it was $50 or $100, the amount of value that a person gets today from spending $100 and then being vaccinated against COVID, like there's so much value creation there and then so much cash going into medical research. Like to me, that's like amazing.
Agreed. And you know, why a vaccine manufacturer should be expected to sell at cost to, say, the US government, not it, right? Or frankly, to Europe. Now, what's a different argument is when it comes to the developing world, right? I don't think that you're going to find that you know, Uganda, not to single out any one country, but that they're going to be able to pay the same amount that the US can afford to. And so I think that's really where the issue of equity comes into play. And if Europe can offer that higher price, does that disadvantage these other countries who can't pay that higher price? Mm. Now Europe's going to have the first foot in the door.
Yeah.
So it's complicated, but I do fundamentally agree with you that sort of just saying, well, it's a pandemic, you know, you shouldn't profit off a pandemic, I think is a rather blunt argument. I think there's some nuance to it that perhaps there's not an easy answer to, or you know, a totally fair answer. But I think it's too blunt of an answer.
Mm. Well, I think it comes back to that long-standing political issue where companies charge huge fortunes for their drugs in the United States and effectively subsidize the rest of the world. In a weird way, if you're charging tens of thousands of dollars for treatment or hundreds of thousands in the United States and then effectively giving it for free in Uganda, that kind of makes sense. But I guess the issue is places like the UK and the EU pay dramatically lower prices than the United States. And so there's a political movement in the US is like, let's have the prices of the rest of the world.
Yeah.
That would just blow the whole thing up because that is they're subsidizing everyone. So if you took them, if anything, the rest of the EU and the UK would have to start pulling their weight and pay higher prices if you wanted to equalize those prices. Yeah, which probably kind of makes sense. I mean, everyone's like, actually, no, I've never really thought about this, but you know, everyone like gripes on about how the costs in the US going up so much and how much more expensive it is there than the rest of the world. Most of the development comes from the United States. Certainly most of the funding from those big pots of gold, those like high prices. So maybe it's not as simple as it looks. It's not the big bad Americans, you know, charging too much.
It is absolutely central to the problem is the way that reimbursement for pharmaceuticals is done, right? Mm. I think actually the most interesting example of this is antibiotic development, right? Yeah. So, I mean, this is just the classic social good, right? When antibiotic, we are facing, you know, rapidly growing increases in antibiotic resistance. Every time that we develop a brand new antibiotic with a novel mechanism of action, resistance will pop up, is popping up faster and faster and faster. You know, it's sometimes it's only, you know, a few months before we document resistance to a brand new antibiotic. And part of the reason for that is that as soon as we have a brand new antibiotic that that one of these pharmaceutical companies has spent millions and millions of dollars developing, they need to make money from it, right? And so they need to recoup those costs. And so the way that they recoup those costs is they try to sell that drug. And there's only so expensive that you can make, you know, a single dose or a course of an antibiotic, right? That is, you know, reasonable. And so once you hit that ceiling of how expensive the antibiotic is, you know, that people would be able or willing or insurers would be able and willing to pay for it, then you need to make up the rest of the costs with volume, right? With volume of sales. And so, yeah, these pharmaceutical companies then go out and push increased use of this very expensive antibiotic in order to make up the costs. And that increased use is what is breeding resistance faster and faster and faster.
Dang, I didn't understand that dynamic.
Yeah, and so, you know, there are very logical arguments that suggest that antibiotic development should be publicly funded, should be government funded, right? Irrespective of who does it, who does the development, it should be government funded such that the need to make up for spent, you know, for expenditure in development costs is no longer there, right? And so that drug can be used, the analogy is that it should be the break glass in case of emergency only, right?
Yeah.
That should be the very last thing that you reach for to treat the most resistant infection. And you do so in a manner that is hyper-controlled, where, you know, you try to absolutely limit the chance that anybody else is ever infected with that particular strain or colony of bacteria. Yeah. That's what we should be doing antibiotics. But instead, we're doing this develop it, use it, throw it away approach.
Mm. So what do you think about, what do you think, we've been doing a bit of work on Alzheimer's, which has always been an interest of mine. And we're looking at this new hypothesis that's actually been around for a few years now, that it's actually one of the causes is gingivitis, gum disease. Mm. Having spent like a bit of time on it and spoken to a couple of companies working in the space, what are your thoughts on that, Rob?
Oh, I should probably floss a little bit more, I think.
Yeah, I've booked a dentist appointment for next week. After.
Very good, very good.
So what's the idea, right? These gingivalis bacteria, the idea is they get into your bloodstream and they're pretty nasty stuff. Like they're basically dissolve and digest proteins.
but the preclinical data and supporting evidence behind their central hypothesis is compelling. It's perhaps the most compelling that I've seen in the field. Albeit I'm not a neurologist, I'm not a dementia expert, but I am trained to read research papers and interpret evidence, and I can tell you that it is very compelling. Now, whether or not this company has the answer or not, or has the full story or not, I think this is likely to be at least a part of the puzzle that they've stumbled across.
Well, it's interesting that the issue with Alzheimer's, for those unaware, there's been like a long, like 40-year hypothesis that it's caused by these alpha beta amyloid or potentially tau proteins tangling up. Whereas now there's been hundreds of drugs targeting that, and many that have efficiently cleared those alpha beta amyloid plaques without curing the disease. There was never a causal link established. It was always just association. Whereas this one, at the very least, they've been able to infect poor mice with gingivalis and then create these symptoms.
That's right.
First time there's actually a causal link. And it's obviously in mice and blah, blah, blah. There's so many caveats and who knows like how relevant that is. But it is there. There is some degree of causality established. What's the other one? The other compelling piece was that 95% of Alzheimer's patients had it in their brain at high concentrations of this bacteria in their, what, in their neurons, was it? And the general population is much lower.
I think we can just say what they have publicly released, which is that that they've found P. gingivalis in a high proportion of, I don't know the exact number, high proportion of CSF samples from Alzheimer's patients, and they've found the gingipanes in association with tau deposits in the brain on autopsy.
The gingipanes are the proteins that gingivalis uses to effectively eat you.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. These gingipanes are
now localized.
Yeah. And so what happens is it gets in, the hypothesis is it gets in through your gums. So these bacteria are very happy there, but they get into the bloodstream. And it's also like that, this lines up with other evidence. For example, there's always been this thing, and it's been a bit of a meme on the internet. You should always floss because people live longer if you floss. I think that's been like a well-established thing.
That meme, actually.
Yeah, it's just like, and you should floss. Like if anybody's giving any advice on the internet, you're supposed to add and floss every day. It's just, I don't know, it's a bad red thing. I'm spending too much time on this.
Apparently you're more of an internet aficionado than I am.
But again, that's a correlation. So you can't draw anything from that. If somebody flosses every day, they probably exercise every day. They're probably healthy. They're probably well-rounded individuals. They're probably not stressed. They're probably
balanced. This is the problem with observational data, right?
Yeah, but it does fit. It does fit that, the observation. Well,
let me assure the viewers of this podcast that we didn't make any investment decisions based off the fact that Mike likes flossing.
Hey, do you know what we should have done? We should have made investment decisions based on memes. Like the best investments this year were all meme stocks. In a weird way, there's almost a certain justice to it. It's like if you create a funny name for cryptocurrency, people are going to buy it. And the other thing that's interesting about this is, and it relates to NFTs and all this other stuff, crypto didn't exist 10 years ago, 11 years ago. And now you've got $2 trillion of this stuff. And that $2 trillion is sitting on the most random, strange people's balance sheets you can imagine around the world. Yeah. And so when people bid up an NFT, they're not bidding up with like US dollars that they earn by earning twice as much and paying tax and blah, blah, blah. It's just money they just kind of like been created and a value they've got. And that's what's bidding. You don't buy a Dogecoin with US dollars. You buy it with Bitcoin or Ethereum. And in that context, again, think about the NFTs and what's happening in the art world where people are paying tens of millions of dollars for art. It kind of almost makes sense if you think like, let's say you just bought a bunch of Bitcoin, it's now worth $100 million. Maybe you would spend a bit of that on art. Maybe you spend a few million dollars on crypto art.
Especially if it has a little bit of crypto attached to it. It's got a poetic justice to it.
And that wraps up this episode. If you'd like to know more about us, you can find us at www.frazerscapitalpartners.com. And thanks for listening in.